From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. Bob Garfield is away this week. I'm Brooke Gladstone. And these are starlings. The U.S. is infested with starlings because of Shakespeare. On a snowy March morning in 1890, a bard and bird-loving drug maker named Eugene Shefflin released 60 starlings because they'd once been mentioned by Shakespeare in Central Park. There are now some 200 million of them larding our homeland with guano. As the bard once said, a pestilence hangs in our air. Then again, you might say the same about him, depending on your first encounter. A recent unscientific survey taken in Manhattan's Washington Square Park suggests that for some, Shakespeare was snuffed by pedagogy's cold, dead hand.
Any personal experience?
High school, having to read it all the time and not really understanding the language.
I appreciate his work, however, I don't feel as if I connected to it now.
But we met a bunch of, I'm guessing, fourth graders who saw it differently.
Praise.
Poetry.
Happiness.
All people.
Happy.
I'm awesome.
Can you quote any?
No. She might be small, but she's fierce.
That's from Midsummer.
That's on my shirt.
That's on her shirt.
In fact, some educators believe that high school is already too late to meet the bard. Students are too self-conscious to ask for the meanings of words and phrases, and with college looming, they're too worried about grades. So when's the right time? We'd argue right now. It's his 400th death day, and even if it's all Greek to you, his phrase, even if he sets your teeth on edge, also his, he is in your mouth. As the great British journalist Bernard Levin once noted, if you've ever played fast and loose or refused to budge an inch, believe the game is up or that the truth will out, ever been tongue-tied or hoodwinked, made a virtue of necessity or seen better days, had too much of a good thing, lived in a fool's paradise, or given the devil his due, even if you bid me good riddance, but me no buts, for you are quoting Shakespeare. But why Shakespeare? What? And especially, who? The answers to those questions are swallowed in confusion, his phrase.
I was visiting a school on the Upper West Side, talking to fourth graders about Shakespeare's sonnets.
That's Columbia professor James Shapiro, author of many books about Shakespeare and his times.
One of the kids raised his hand and said, "My big brother told me that Shakespeare didn't write Romeo and Juliet. Is that true?" And it was one of those moments of reckoning. It wasn't a situation in which I could muster up my professorial authority like I do in my Columbia classrooms and say that's rubbish and I'll fail you if you ask that question again.
Now, at this point, some listeners, those who take the view that the man we know as Shakespeare did not actually write the works attributed to him, will be tempted, as someone once wrote, to cry havoc and let slip the dogs of war. And it's true that Professor Shapiro, like most of his colleagues in academe, believe the man from Stratford is, in fact, the author. But we won't fix on resolving that question. We're far more interested in the way that war has been waged across centuries.
There are people who think that Francis Bacon wrote the plays, the Earl of Oxford wrote the plays. There are 70 other candidates for the plays.
Professor Shapiro will serve as my Virgil for the hour.
What became interesting to me was not what people thought, but why they thought it. And it turns out some of the smartest people, Mark Twain, Sigmund Freud, Henry James, Helen Keller, it's a long list, joined this company of Shakespeare deniers who, for really complicated and very interesting and sometimes sad reasons, had to deny his authorship.
But it does start with the fact there's very little documentary evidence about Shakespeare.
There's more about Shakespeare than about almost any other Englishman from his day who had the kind of life that he did. Absolutely. We just don't have a lot of records because four centuries later, those records don't survive. And the records that do survive official documents, real estate, marriage, death, baptism. Those are the kind of things that were recorded. The kind of things we actually wanted to know about Shakespeare today. Who did he sleep with? What were his political views? Was he cozy with Queen Elizabeth or King James? Those are not the sorts of—
Did he like his wife?
What do we do with that second best bed he left? Was that the good bed, the bed that couldn't be brought downstairs? I mean, what's that about? So we don't have answers to those questions, and they're really the kind of questions we want answers to.
Right, and Shakespeare the artist didn't seem to square with Shakespeare of these documents, Shakespeare who wrote the will, or Shakespeare who brought people to court to get his loans paid back.
There are two issues really here. One is the discrepancy between those official documents and the romantic Shakespeare that we want to know about, or the political Shakespeare. The problem is that we also project back onto Shakespeare certain assumptions about his age that are not true. The whole notion of literature as autobiographical, as self-expression, was not Shakespeare's culture. And if we are trying to shoehorn Shakespeare into a confessional writer about his sexual life, about his religious beliefs, we're not going to get close to who the man was.
But in every generation, we crave connection. In 1794, a local doctor wrote in his diary that he'd wrested Shakespeare's skull from his grave because skulls held secrets, and also to win a hefty bet made by politician and author Horace Walpole. But only last month did radar reveal that he may have succeeded.
Archaeologists who recently scanned the grave of William Shakespeare say they have discovered that his skull appears to be missing.
The finding supports a claim, first made in 1879, but long dismissed as myth, that the bard's skull was stolen by grave robbers in the 18th century.
Blessed be the man that spares these stones, and cursed be he that moves my bones.
But did he rest in peace?
It's presumed the skull was sought because of the belief back then that its size and shape could reveal a person's character. But you can't solve the mystery of genius by pillaging a corpse. Nor can you reconcile Shakespeare's artistry with the stingy documents he left behind. Nor can you find the lived reality of the man in his poems and plays.
We live in an age in which you get an MFA in writing and the first thing you're told is you have to live it to write it. From some alcoholic teacher who slept with half his class and is encouraging them to write about alcoholic teachers who sleep with half their class. And it's not true. You don't have to go to the moon to write science fiction. You don't have to be an animal to write Animal Farm. The truth is you have to have an imagination. It all turns on that.
But sometimes imagination fails. Take the first great Shakespeare scholar, an Irishman named Edmund Malone.
He'd cut out little bits and pieces from rare materials that passed through his hands. He wouldn't return library books.
But it's really serious because there aren't multiple copies in those days.
He was handling things that were unique. Nobody else has ever found a letter written to Shakespeare. And he found it. And he decided not to publish it. Why? Because it only showed Shakespeare involved in lending money. And he didn't want to tarnish Shakespeare's reputation in that way. So the story really gets going, you know, 1780s, 1790s, as people are trying to figure out, okay, he's the greatest writer who's ever lived. He's the god of our idolatry. Garrick, the great 18th century Shakespeare actor, is creating the first Shakespeare festival. There are now a gazillion in the world.
How come?
The interest in Shakespeare the man and the interest in the plays and the ways in which the two fit together is something that each age has to wrestle with. And the answers that each age comes up with, who was this man and what does that tell us about the plays or the poems, says more about that age than it does about anything of Shakespeare himself.
Let's talk about Edmund Malone and his method, because the greatest Shakespeare scholar, you say, of all time may have committed the original sin when he focuses on the sonnets, and particularly Sonnet 93.
Yeah, what I really, really can't forgive is He's trying to write the great biography of Shakespeare. He knows more than anyone else. And yet he can't tell the story because too much information is lost. So Malone decided there was one great source that was going to tell him everything he needed to know. And that was the complete works of William Shakespeare, which he had been editing. So he comes across this sonnet, which is about a man accusing his wife of adultery.
If you'll forgive me, so shall I live, supposing thou art true, like a deceived husband. Unless you want to do it.
No, I love to hear it, but I need the anger of the deceived husband.
All right, I'll do it again. So shall I live, supposing thou art true, like a deceived husband, so love's face may still seem love to me, though altered new. Thy looks with me, thy heart in other place, for there can live no hatred in thine eye. Therefore, in that, I cannot know thy change.
So you read that, you know she's cheating on him. He's living in London, writing those plays. She's up in Stratford doing who knows what with who knows whom, right? I mean, that's what Malone's thinking. And then he says, here, I have the will. He left her the second best bed just to show her he knows she's cheating on him. All of a sudden, he's taken this huge leap to read the works as autobiography. And that is the original sin, and it's the slipperiest slope that ever a scholar slid down. Malone, for the record, couldn't find a wife. So here's a kind of loser guy projecting onto Shakespeare anger at women. So this is the second half of that equation. The first half is, yeah, Shakespeare wrote autobiographically. The second is, whoever is claiming that tends to claim that Shakespeare is just like them. Marxist Shakespeares think that Shakespeare is writing Marxist stuff. Jews think that Shakespeare is writing sympathetically to Jews. You know, you can go right down the list. And it's something about his works that make us want to read them autobiographically and make us want to project ourselves into those works.
But if the autobiographical details you believe you found in the works don't seem to match the man who authored them, then you must seek another man.
For all anybody knows and can prove, this man never wrote a play in his life. For all anybody knows and can prove, this man never wrote a letter in his life. Handwriting experts have questioned whether he could write at all.
That was Michael Dunn, a faithful Oxfordian. That is, one who believes Edward de Vere, the Earl of Oxford, was the true author of Shakespeare's canon. Coming up, the Oxfordians, the Baconians, that is to say, the anti-Stratfordians through the ages, and what their convictions say about our infinite capacity to believe or not to believe. This is On the Media.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone. Now it's time for war, or revelation, depending on your point of view. First, a brisk summary of the two main points driving the Shakespeare deniers. Point one, as we heard, no evidence. None of the existing documents connected to him can confirm that he was even educated. In fact, his handwriting was atrocious, and he didn't always spell his name the same way. No records suggest the folks of Stratford ever knew him as a writer, only as a merchant, occasional tax evader, grain hoarder, and litigant. Point two, it's just not possible. This son of a glove maker knew too much of court politics and culture, too much of foreign lands, of falconry, of law, of literary form, too much of human nature. No, this man from Stratford could not be the god of our idolatry. The so-called bard was at best a beard. But for whom? In 1850, the game is afoot, the path previously having been laid by a revolution in critical analysis and the toppling of two sorts of gods.
The first was dethroning Homer as an author.
Jim Shapiro, author of Contested Will.
Scholars come along and they're looking at these texts and they say, well, they're written over a couple of hundred years, and either Homer lived for hundreds of years and changed his style in unbelievably irreconcilable ways, or the man we call Homer is an invention.
And this basically is the beginning of higher criticism. Lower criticism is the study of textual minutiae. Higher criticism concerns a work's origins, date, mode of composition, transmission, etc.
It's sometimes dangerous because it's one thing to knock Homer off the pedestal, but after that, the next move was to knock Jesus off the pedestal by pointing out discrepancies in the Gospels. And to make this claim was heretical.
And David Strauss in 1835 argued that the Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, John, couldn't have been eyewitnesses to Jesus's life. It lays out a really strong case. It's so strong that a dozen years later, a man named Samuel Schmucker decides to mock the whole idea.
Schmucker's this future preacher, young man in Pennsylvania. He is a deep believer in Jesus, and he's a deep believer in Shakespeare. He's so outraged by the argument of this higher criticism that's trying to challenge the legitimacy of the Gospels that he makes an argument. Yeah, let's say the same thing about Shakespeare.
As a reductio ad absurdum.
Exactly.
If Jesus can be taken down this way, I'll just show you the fatuousness of this approach by using something that is absolutely untouchable.
And he didn't know it, but he wrote the playbook for the anti-Shakespeare movement ever after.
Enter Delia Bacon, the youngest daughter of a deceased Congregationalist minister who left the family impoverished in New England. A dazzling intellect, she delivered celebrated lectures on Shakespeare at a girls' school, but her ambition was tightly bridled by her religious family.
Hardcore Puritan, that's the way to think of it. You know, everything but the buckles on the shoes and the cap. And she tried moving to New York and creating a life as a writer. And every time she strayed a little too far, the pressure from the family pulled her back into the fold. Delia Bacon is one of the most underrated intellectuals in American history. And the more I learned about her, the sadder the story became.
An esteemed lecturer, now entrenched in Shakespeare, she developed a close friendship with a fellow lodger, Alexander McWhorter, 11 years younger, a Yale divinity student. Delia thought he loved her, and she wrote letters professing the same, but he did not. In fact, he read her letters out loud to amuse his friends. Yale Divinity School held a public trial to determine if he'd deceived her.
She was completely disgraced. The verdict went against her, and she was unmarriageable. She fled to England just to get away. She now had a mission. She was going to prove that others, led by Francis Bacon, no relation, were responsible for writing the plays and poetry of William Shakespeare.
It was deeply controversial, but she did have Emerson's backing.
She had Emerson's backing.
Hawthorne went along with it.
Hawthorne bankrolled the publication of her unreadable book. Her Shakespeare was a radical. And the group of writers around Francis Bacon responsible for the plays and poems?
Basically a cabal of writers that were trying to overthrow the
tyrannical regime of Queen Elizabeth and then King James.
Because the purpose thing and grows by plot to curb the will of the nobility. Suffered and live with such as cannot rule nor ever will be ruled.
And what she was trying to do was say, look, the received story of the foundation of all the values that Americans have from the pilgrims who were religious dissenters is not true. The true spirit of republicanism, which is in this country, comes from these men, Francis Bacon and his cohort, who gave us plays like Coriolanus and Julius Caesar, which are radical anti-monarchical plays.
I come to bury Caesar, not to praise him.
Anybody reading this at the time must have thought, oh my God, she's trying to topple the very story of Thanksgiving, of Puritans founding the Republican values that give us our government.
Did Delia Bacon go crazy?
Delia Bacon lost her sanity in the last 2 years of her life, and a nephew came and rescued her, brought her back to the States, and she was put into a place for the insane, and she died 2 years later. But she certainly was not insane when she came up with this idea. She was quite brilliant.
She was the first Baconian, but there were notable others, among them Helen Keller, Walt Whitman, and Mark Twain.
Mark Twain believed you could only write what you knew because he tended to write about what he knew, his days on the Mississippi, his time out in California. He was one of the great autobiographical writers. So he was convinced that whoever wrote these plays had to have lived through those experiences. And he was pretty clear Shakespeare of Stratford could not and did not do so. He was a Baconian and a committed one. Twain and Helen Keller and others are part of this late 19th, early 20th century shift.
It was Keller who brought Twain stunning new evidence of the Bacon theory.
This is extraordinary weekend up in Connecticut where Mark Twain is living. And Helen Keller goes up there with her friend and nurse who had recently married a Harvard lecturer named Macy. And Macy was a deep Shakespeare denier. And he brings with him a book which has these kind of acrostics. In other words, if you read all the way down on page 72 of the folio.
Take the first letter of each line, it reads Francisco Bacano. Or, in other words, it inaugurates the great search for a cipher, a code embedded in Shakespeare that will ultimately and finally prove that it was somebody else.
And it makes great sense because this is the time where Morse code is invented, ciphers are huge.
So explain to me the motivation of Twain. I mean, he said, I have allowed myself for so many years the offensive privilege of laughing at people who believed in Shakespeare that I will perish with shame if the clergyman's book, this is the one about the cipher, fails to unseat that grossly commercial wool stapler.
Yeah, well, you know, there's more than a literal literary rivalry here. I mean, Twain was the first great branded writer of our day. The white suit, the pipe, he even endorsed products. This was a guy who was a brand. And he had to figure, hey, when I go to my hometown of Hannibal, they're pouring down the streets and everybody could tell stories about me. If Shakespeare was as great as people say he was, why didn't people pour out in the streets in Stratford and write little bits? Doesn't make sense to me.
But why choose Bacon as the hidden bard anyway? Well, he did fit the era's model of what a genius should be. A Cambridge-educated parliamentarian and erstwhile Lord Chancellor, author of literary, legal, and religious works, proclaimed by some the father of the scientific method. Later, he was disgraced for taking bribes, and his poetry apparently stunk, but viewed through the right lens, he was a master of obscure arts, a principled, though thwarted, power, a veritable Prospero.
But this rough magic I here abjure. And when I have required some heavenly music, which even now I do, to work mine ends upon their senses that this airy charm is for, I'll break my staff, bury it certain fathoms in the earth, and deeper than did ever plummet sound. I'll drown my book.
Prospero must be Bacon's creation. He must, even though, after much exertion, the Baconians never found the hidden cipher to confirm it. By the way, that search did have an unintended consequence.
One of the people who got invested in the ciphers early on, a brilliant man named William Friedman, became a code breaker because of that. And he was responsible, along with others, for helping to break Code Purple, the great Japanese code that was responsible for the loss of so much life in the Pacific Theater during the Second World War.
So, victory in the Pacific.
Thank God for the Shakespeare controversy.
But the certainty that Bacon wrote the plays and expressed his personal pain through characters like Prospero gave way to another candidate as author, another character through which he spoke.
Bloody, bawdy villain, remorseless, treacherous, lecherous, kindless villain, oh, vengeance!
Why, what an ass am I?
Hamlet was not a magician, or a king, or a fierce and fatal warrior like Macbeth. Hamlet was a kid, a tangle of impulse, desire, and doubt. Hamlet was modern. As Victor Hugo said in 1835, Hamlet is not you or I, he is every one of us. Hamlet is not a man, he is man. And he was just what the doctor ordered.
Sigmund Freud, at the tail end of the 19th century, was struggling. Freud's father died, and he was thrown into a powerful depression that he struggled to find his way out of. And he came up with a theory that we all know as the Oedipal theory, that men want to kill their fathers and sleep with their mothers. But the real story he was grappling with was not the great story of Oedipus Rex, but the story of Hamlet. So Hamlet gets rewritten not as a political story, but as a story of a man who is wrestling with the death of his father and who can't kill Claudius because Claudius has acted out his own Oedipal desires. Claudius has killed Hamlet's father and Claudius has slept with Hamlet's mother. So you can't kill somebody for doing what you deeply desire to do.
Why, what an ass am I? This is most brave. That I, the son of a dear father, murdered. Prompted to my revenge by heaven and hell, must, like a whore, unpack my heart with words.
It all clicked for Freud, and he was so excited because he had not only figured out how he thought everybody behaved in the world, but he also had solved the mystery of Hamlet.
And the fundamental fact was that Hamlet was written after the death of Shakespeare's father.
Yeah, Shakespeare, as far as Freud knew, and he got this from a biography by George Brandes, wrote Hamlet immediately upon the death of his own father, John Shakespeare, in 1601. Shakespeare's father dies. Shakespeare works out his Oedipal complex. Freud's father dies a couple hundred years later, and Freud works out his Oedipal complex and solves the mystery of Hamlet in one go. What a great day that must have been. He started promoting this idea, and everything was going pretty well until George Brandes wrote a follow-up book that indicated Shakespeare had written Hamlet before the death of his father. So if you're Sigmund Freud, you're left with two choices. One, say, my theory's still pretty good, but the basis of it is untrue. Or you could say, the only explanation has to be that William Shakespeare did not write Hamlet. Somebody else whose father had died, who had a mother he longed for, must have written it.
Enter Edward de Vere, 17th Earl of Oxford, a one-time ward of Queen Elizabeth, writer, art patron, world traveler.
Yeah, I mean, de Vere was captured by pirates, and so was Hamlet. De Vere's father died young, allowing Freud to make the argument for that Oedipal figure. De Vere wrote poetry. He was praised as a writer. and
had three daughters like Leo.
There you go.
But the biography of De Vere is really a pretty dissipated guy and who wasn't even in the country a lot of the time. And
yeah, if you truly want to be honest about it, then you have to accept all the biographical details and read the life against it. For example, some of De Vere's aristocratic friends claim that De Vere had sex with an animal. Does that mean we read the end of Richard III, My Kingdom for a Horse, in a romantic way? I mean, if you're in for a dollar, you got to be in for the whole thing. So it's a tricky, tricky road to follow.
Another little bump in that road, his death.
Yeah, he died in 1604, before the last decade of Shakespeare's writing career. That has never been an obstacle for believers.
So what plays did he write posthumously?
Well, he must have put in a drawer in 1604 before he died Measure for Measure, King Lear, Macbeth, Antony and Cleopatra, Coriolanus, Pericles, and Pericles is written with George Wilkins. It's not just dead men don't write plays. Dead men do not collaborate with living writers on plays.
But many have believed those plays were put in a drawer. Such actors as Orson Welles, Sir John Gielgud, Jeremy Irons, Supreme Court Justices John Paul Stevens and Antonin Scalia, and filmmaker Roland Emmerich, who makes Oxford's Case in the 2011 film Anonymous.
Why must you continue to humiliate my family?
The voices, I can't stop them. They come to me. When I sleep, when I wake, when I sup, when I walk down the hall. The sweet longings of a maiden, the surging ambitions of a courtier, the foul designs of a murderer, the wretched pleas of his victims. Only when I put their words, their voices, to parchment, only then is my mind quieted.
I think it's deeply disturbing to a lot of people to imagine that somebody grew up in a middling class who received a grammar school education, which is equivalent to a college education today, could write the greatest works ever written. Their gorges rise at that possibility. They don't want to believe it. They want to believe that you have to have money and prestige and access to do so. They don't fundamentally believe in the power of the imagination. One of the great things about Shakespeare deniers of all stripes is there's never a moment where they admit defeat. And I think they never get to that point because the world changes. Our notion of who Shakespeare is keeps changing.
As Ariel said in The Tempest, nothing of him that doth fade, but doth suffer a sea change into something rich and strange. Up next, quite possibly history's most inspiring and perilous performance of Shakespeare. This is On the Media.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Geoffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at The New Yorker. So join us every week on The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone. So now we leave the Anglophone world of the past for the global community of today. The British Council recently conducted an online poll to gauge Shakespeare love in 15 nations. Topping the list, India, Mexico, Brazil, Turkey, South Africa, China, South Korea. True. Online surveys are not notably reliable, but still, it suggests that Shakespeare translates in ways English speakers cannot easily fathom. In 2005, in Kabul, Afghanistan, a brief moment when the Taliban had been pushed to the periphery, a carpet designer named Qais Akbar Omar helped launch a production of Love's Labor's Lost. It began with the visit of a French actress named Corinne Jobard, pondering with some actors a production. The actors said yes to Shakespeare, but no to tragedy. They'd lived that for 35 years.
We looked into Midsummer's Night's Dream, but it doesn't coordinate with Afghan culture and customs.
But Love's Labor's Lost did?
It did. It did. Corinne actually came up with that play, but we didn't have access to the translation. So she told the actors there are four princes and four princesses, and these four princes take an oath that they are going to study for the next 4 years, and they will not interact with any woman, and they will eat one meal a day. And that sounded very much like Taliban. And all the actors laughed and said, what? Shakespeare actually came up with this 400 years ago? And Corinne said, yep. And so what happens next? And she said, well, then four princesses come to the court, try to talk to the king about some serious issues.
So they set up a tent for them.
Exactly, outside, which is, again, like nomads always living in Afghanistan in tents everywhere all over the country. So that also has a little bit of connection to the Afghan history and culture. And then they said, what happens? And they said, all these four princes fall in love with these beautiful girls. And then what happened next? And they said, well, let's read the play.
This is one of the notable plays of Shakespeare where there are equal numbers of women and men.
Mm-hmm.
And in the end, the women get to make the decision.
That was one of the most important message of the play that we choose this one, because for 6 years, the Taliban did not allow women to work and they were locked inside their houses like prisoners. And in this play, the woman get to make the final decision. It was a great message that no, woman always had an important role in Afghan society, and let's revive that back by this play. Of course, that was happening already, but this play pronounced it a little louder.
And do you think the West has a misconception about that?
They do. They only know of the bloodshed and war, but there is also beautiful other things happening. For example, the love for poetry. We have something called poetry contest. You sit in a circle, and I recite two verses from Omar Khayyam, and you recite two verses from Rumi.
The great Afghan poet.
Exactly, yeah. The first word of your first verse starts with the last letter of my verse. And
wow.
That goes on for hours. And also, it's not just random poetry. We have to talk about something. Let's talk about love, or let's talk about, I don't know.
So you're talking about alternating verses based on mm-hmm. the last letter, and not mm-hmm. just verses, but verses limited to a particular theme.
Exactly. People don't know these things.
Let's leap from your discussion of the importance of poetry to your problems with getting a translation of Love's Labor's Lost. You had to go to an Iranian translation from a famous poet in Tehran who had translated into Farsi all of Shakespeare's
yes.
plays. I know that Dari, one of mm-hmm. Afghanistan's languages, and Farsi are similar, but
very similar.
They're yeah. not the same. Did you run into a problem there?
Oh, yeah. It was a huge problem. The difference between Dari and Farsi, you know, it's like the difference between old Shakespearean English with a modern-day American English. But we start to read a little more. We got, you know, hang of it. And then we said, oh, wow, this is actually very beautiful. And then by the time we gave the play to the actors, it was amazing. It was more like a poetry contest. Some of the actors, of course, could not read. One of our actresses was a beggar who became famous doing a movie called Osama.
She was a child then. She basically came into a restaurant where the director was begging for money, and he said, I got to put you on film. She was brilliant, but she couldn't read, and she still lived in terrifically poverty-stricken circumstances when you guys tracked her down.
Yes. I mean, she was famous. She made this movie, but she didn't make much money out of it, enough to buy a piece of land, build a few rooms. She never had a chance to actually go to school during the years of Taliban. And the same thing with some of the other actresses.
Although some of those actresses were real dynamos.
Yes. Two of the actresses, one Sabah Sahar, another Birshna Bahar, both of them actually work with the Ministry of Interior as detectives. These are really educated people. they were professional actors. They were, you know, reading it like as if it is their own language, as if, you know, they wrote the play. And one of the actors, his name is Faisal, he believed that Shakespeare was an Afghan who migrated to England 400 years ago. And there he wrote probably one or two plays and he got famous. And he stopped calling himself an Afghan and he became Englishman.
He was convinced of this.
He really believed it. And I said, why do you say that? And he said, Shakespeare writes like Rumi. The only difference is that Rumi's poetry is all about spirituality, God, and all these issues, while Shakespeare writes to entertain people, to make people laugh, and historical issues. But the quality of the language is the same. So how come two people existed, one in Afghanistan, one in England? They must be related. And I said, you make a good point.
But they weren't speaking Shakespeare's words. They'd had to go through several series of translations. I mean, can you, as someone who knew the original so well, say that they were speaking the language of Shakespeare?
You know, Shakespeare, it was very similar to Afghan culture more than any other cultures in the world, because we still live like we were in the 16th century in some parts of the country, and especially with all these rules against women, especially with Taliban just pushed out of the picture, but the memories were still fresh in people's minds. Plus, the quality of the language, when the actors recited their lines written by Shakespeare 400 years ago, it felt very natural.
And the poetry was preserved, you believe?
Yes, very much so, because when you change a word in Shakespeare, the whole thing kind of loses balance. The whole verse loses its balance. And then you know that something is wrong in here. And it happened a few times in the translation process. One actor or another would say, it doesn't rhyme properly. It doesn't go very well here. Something is wrong. I want to replace it with this word or that word. And then we went and studied both the English and the Dari. And they said, oh, gosh, yes, this word needs to be replaced with this one. It's just amazing. It's like a formula. If you take one number off, everything doesn't make sense.
Marina Golbahari, the very young girl who played Osama in that famous film, was, as you say, illiterate. Could she keep up with this?
Not in the beginning when we started it. So I had to spend 3 weeks or more going to the park every day before we start our rehearsals. And I read with her and three actresses. She's an encyclopedia of emotions. And it was just amazing. It just flowed, the whole thing, which is why the first day of the performance, we had enough space for over 500, and there were 250 or 300 people waiting outside, and we just could not let them in. They were mostly men, except for a few foreign women who were diplomats. So these Afghan men, the next night, they came back with their whole families, their sisters, their aunts, their mothers, because they did not see that there was anything un-Islamic. It was just a very, very beautiful play. The third performance we had in Bobber's Garden, we had over 1,000 people for the audience.
Now, this garden you mentioned, a garden that was still undergoing restoration because the Taliban and the Civil War had destroyed it.
Yes.
While that performance was going on, the workers also just stopped and watched.
Yes. They just sat cross-legged on dirt on the floor, smiling. And that was everything for us. After the play, 100 people in their 20s came to me and asked me, who is this guy? Who wrote this? And I said, Shakespeare. And he said, who is Shakespeare? And I said, he's an Englishman. And he said, yeah, but that wasn't there. And I said, yeah, we translated it. And he said, wow, can we have the script? So I had my script and I gave it to him. And that script was copied probably 100 times until the lines were unreadable. But at the very last page, I had my phone number. And they start calling me and asking for copies.
How many calls?
Oh, quite a few, quite a few. I had to go and change my number. I just told one of the guys and I said, stop calling me. There is Foundation for Cultural and Civil Society. And I left a few hundred copies there. Then you can make your own photocopies. And that's what happened. And the funny thing is, one of my neighbors one day gave me a copy of it. And I said, hey, have you read this thing? And I said, yeah, I have read this thing. And he said, this is amazing, isn't it? And I said, yeah. You know, Brooke, this is the thing. People don't understand that Afghanistan is so thirsty and there is so much talent in that country, all waiting for something to happen so that they can just grab that opportunity and move on with their lives. Unfortunately, because of war and Taliban returning back, when the suicide bombers start coming back, you know, in America, you only hear about a suicide bomber killed 12 people in Kabul. But in Kabul, you see the whole thing on TV. They show the blood on the street and the body parts lying from the trees. When you see that, you kind of lose hope for the future. We were planning to take this play all over the country.
The popularity of the show was accompanied by a certain degree of risk. Could you describe that?
Well, the popularity of the show, one thing. Second thing, because it was by an English playwright. Third, it was funded by a foreign organization. Fourth, if the Taliban killed any of us, they would get a lot of publicity out of this. So that's why we just could not risk it.
Was anybody hurt?
One of the actresses, her name is Parveen Mushtail. She is now in Canada with her two teenage daughters and son. Someone knocked on their door. The husband went out to see who was knocking, and he never came back. And the next day, the neighbors found out that her husband was killed, put in a ditch, in a really brutal way. I don't want to talk about the details of that. That actually makes me sad. The woman that earlier we were talking about, Brishna Bahar and Sabah Sahar, who were both
detectives,
yeah. She had to leave her town because people start calling her that she was a whore. And when someone creates that kind of rumor about you, you just have to get out before the crowd kills you. And Sabah Sahar, her family told her to stop making movies. She did not listen because she's a very strong-willed woman and she wanted to do this. So her husband divorced her and took the children away from her because he's afraid that someone probably will kill her, and along the way he would be killed and their children will be killed as well. So I don't know where she is now. She completely disappeared. All the actors went to different directions, and some who are still in Afghanistan are keeping a very, very low profile so that they don't become victim of some stupid people who would get some publicity out of them.
Let's conclude by going over what makes Shakespeare so relevant to the people of Afghanistan.
During the 4 years of civil war, as soon as you walk out of your house, a sniper from the mountain will shoot you. I mean, that was the reality of life until we had ceasefire briefly for a day or two and people ran out of their basements to get some food, and then there was war all over again. And when you're in the basement, all you hear is hundreds of rockets raining all over your neighborhood every day. So I grew up in the basement, and every book we had in the house, I read them probably more than 10 times, including a couple of plays by Shakespeare. So when we decided to do Shakespeare, oh, I was just so excited. You know, when I read Shakespeare with Corinne and the actors, we all felt like, whoa, this man manages to get so much of his feelings out in the open. After they finished reading their monologues, they start talking with each other about what happened to them during the years of civil war or the Taliban. They could relate what Shakespeare was saying in those lines with what happened to them in real life. Sometimes you don't want to talk about the past, but you want to talk about things that happened to you in a kind of opaque but yet poetic way. And that's what was happening among these actors. Sometimes they openly talked about their past. Sometimes they tried to shield it with those beautiful words. We don't have therapy in Afghanistan, and that's, I think, the best therapy they could have through the lines of Shakespeare. And that was more like a, like, I don't know how to explain it. It's like freedom, you know? And then you just feel light.
If you were to produce another play in Afghanistan, what do you think it would be?
I'll choose another comedy. As one of my actors explained it very beautifully, when we do tragedies one day, we will write it ourselves. And we'll write it the way it happened. Rockets, bombs, blood, and we'll show all of those things on a stage to the people. So I'll go with something very funny to just make people forget about the past, even if it is for half an hour.
What about All's Well That Ends Well?
That would be nice, except not yet. If we have peace, yes. But I will hold on to that for now.
Kais, thank you very much.
Oh, thank you. Great talking to you, Brooke.
Kais Akbar Omar is the author of A Night in the Emperor's Garden. As he said, in the end, we each have to tell our own stories. But in the 400 years since Shakespeare's death, it's pretty clear that he set the template for all of our stories, at once unique and universal. Yes, his words are not our words. As Omar said, that's why they give us the gift of a little distance. That is, just before plunging us deep into the impenetrable mystery that is every life. That's it for this week's show. Kimmy Regler did the heavy lifting for this hour, and thanks to Amy Pearl for inspiring it. On the Media is a production of WNYC Studios. Bob Garfield will be back next week. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
Support for On the Media comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio.